up to you for $90,000. Before he could change his mind. And we bought that building. That's a major thing. We bought the lot. And
wow.
And I had the building raised because it was, I let the family live in there until fall came. And, but it was absolutely non-livable for another winter. So the family had to move out and find another place to live. And I had the house raised. It was, and the next spring, I built my own building on there. And anyway.
And that was in St. Paul?
In St. Paul,
or was that West St. Paul? Or
no, that was
right
east
in
St. Paul. St. Paul, yeah.
East side of St. Paul.
One block north of where I opened my office above the drugstore.
Oh, wow.
And when I opened my, the other thing that...
Is that building still there?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I'll go buy it sometime.
Yeah, it's accepting that I sold the building when I had to quit practice when medicine became big business. I would be practicing today if they would let me continue practicing for $2 and $3 office calls and $60 for a delivery and $150 for an appendix. But medicine became big business. I quit. If I have to be subject to the insurance bureaucracies, and if I can't do my own thing, and what they wanted you to do is to do more and more testing because the money was in technology.
So yeah.
I wouldn't buy it. I told them if my cerebrally augmented visually assisted hand scan doesn't count for anything anymore, I quit.
Yeah. Oh, that's one way of putting it.
And, you know, I quit, and my wife practiced with me for 7 years, but she quit about a year before I came.
Okay.
She practiced with me, and I gave her free hand, accepting that the insurance companies and the University of Minnesota told me she is not to do any surgery. And she's not, they didn't think she was qualified to deliver babies, but she could do it if I would be there. So, but she wanted to be able to do it all by herself. Well, the insurance companies wouldn't disallow it. So then finally, I was the first baby that she was going to deliver. She ran into trouble, and I had to ask her to step aside, and everything was fine. And she never asked me to go back into the delivery room after that. She practiced with me for 7 years. And we had it, the patients could ask for whoever they wanted to. Do you want to see Dr. D or Dr. E? Her name was Dorothea, and mine was Ernie. And the receptionist would answer, you want to see Dr. D or Dr. E? And the receptionist would get such a kick out of it because the 7-8-year-old kids, I want that rough bastard.
No kidding.
They wanted me.
That is funny.
Because I was rough with them, but the kids loved me. I want the fellow who finds crows in my ears and birds singing in my ears. And even my wife couldn't do that.
She didn't have that bedside manner.
She didn't.
Yeah.
But she was. Yeah. And you wouldn't believe this. She practiced for 7 years with me. And I had an accountant. He says, I'm keeping record of who does what. He says, we have a record of this because there might come a time when this will be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And after 7 years, she one time, I was seeing, 9 out of 10 people. And she just wasn't pecking on to the people. That just didn't seem to. I don't know what was the matter. She was a shy girl, but somehow they wanted to see the old man. They wanted to see the rough doctor. The kids would come in. The nurse would ask, who do you want to see? I want to see the rough doctor today.
Now, you mentioned at one point when we were on the phone that you had gotten to know Frank Daneker and his family.
Oh, yeah, Frank. Anyway, I'll button this one up. My wife, one Friday night, said, Daddy, I'm quitting you for good. Well, what the hell happened now? I could never get the best of you, she said. So she quit. And, we've been married, and we've had 6 kids, and now it was a competitive venture all along. We were supposed to be in charge together in this. Well, if I can't get the best of you, I just more extreme competitiveness.
Just like your mother.
Narcissism. It's a narcissistic orientation all over again.
Yeah.
And so she quit me, and she, well, this is a long story, but you mentioned Frankie Daneker. I delivered all his babies.
Wow.
And I had all kinds of, Louis Cardinal, he caught for the Saints.
Now, did Frank Daneker also, were you his doctor too?
Oh, hell, I delivered all his babies, yeah. I took care of Frankie Daneker until he died. I took care of Louis Cardinal until I retired. I delivered all of most those that weren't delivered yet. Louis came up to the office and he said, Lefty, you're going to be my doctor now. So I delivered, I think I delivered the last four or five of these kids. And one time his wife was in labor, and she called me at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And Louis answered the Louis called. My wife is in labor. I said, get her to the hospital. Ah, you're always in such a hurry. You're goddamn crazy left-handed. You're always so much in a hurry. She's got lots of time. I said, Louis, you better get into the hospital. And I'm shaving, he said. I got to shave, finish shaving first. So I dropped everything. And I told the people that go home, I have to go on the delivery. I went over to the Cardinal house, 356 Jenks. His wife was on the floor and the baby was just coming. So we delivered her on the kitchen floor.
Yeah. And what year would that have been roughly?
What's that?
What year was that about?
It must have been about maybe middle 50s or around that time.
Okay.
Or maybe early 60s, around that time. Mm-hmm. But Louis was quite the fellow. He was a catcher for, what the hell was he caught for in an ordinary? And he was a catcher for the Saints. One year when I was with the Millers, I was a rookie at the Millers. He was a regular catcher for the Saints, and Louis Cardinal was. And Frankie Daneker was a second baseman. He was with Winnipeg when I was with Crookston.
Yeah.
And Frankie Daneker was second base for Minneapolis for 7 years.
Yeah.
Well, I delivered all his babies.
Wow.
And I took care of Frankie.
Can you think of any other of the Millers or Saints players that you help with their doctoring?
The only ones I can remember real well is Frankie Daneker and Louis Cardinal. And I don't know if you ever heard of a Sotzer, Cobby Sotzer. Cobby would never made the, I don't know if he played pro ball or not, but he was one hell of a good ball player. I took care of the Sotzer family and the Daneker family and the Cardinal family. And the other thing that made my practice, the coaches for Johnson High School and Harding High School, the coaches and the superintendent, they were all teachers or graduates from St. Olaf and Gustavus and whatnot. And Lefty, I'm glad you're here now. They were all on the east side. They sent me a lot of patients right away.
Wow.
I don't know if you know Louis Cotronio. Do you know him?
No.
Louis, he was a coach. His team won the hockey championship. He too was one of the graduates from an alumni from the Minnesota State College Conference. He was a very faithful supporter of me. All these people were so. Mr. Bowles, I was busy from the word go. I was seeing 40, 50, 60 people a day sometimes. $2 and $3 office calls.
Wow.
And
I guess times have changed. How long have you been retired?
I quit about 10 years now. And I quit when medicine became big business. I couldn't take it. I couldn't take it when the insurance company would tell me, no, you can't admit this patient. You got to treat her here on an outpatient basis. My better judgment tells me she should be hospitalized. Well, we won't authorize. We have the insurance.
All the HMO stuff.
All that stuff. And so when I had to be confronted with that, I kind of decided to quit. But I quit and I sold my building to the funeral director in East Side. The funeral director was right across the street from me. He bought my building and he made it into a Southeast Asian funeral home for the Southeast Asians.
Wow.
They had moved into East Side St. Paul and Groves, you know.
Yeah.
And their funerals lasted for 4 or 5 days. And they would bring in live pigs and chickens and whatnot for the dead person. And also, all the Southeast Asians from Minneapolis and St. Paul all over would converge on that funeral home. And all the parking lots would be taken up by their jalopies for 4 blocks around. But anyway, that didn't work out.
Their jalopies, yeah, I can believe that.
It didn't work out.
Yeah.
And so,
when did the Southeast Chinese first start coming into St. Paul?
They must have started coming about, I couldn't tell you for sure, but I quit about the time when they were beginning to really be
a presence.
I had a hard time with them because if my parking lot held 8 cars, and I had a sign on my building, no patient parking only Mondays through Fridays. But the Southeast Asians completely ignored that. They piled their cars in there, and we had an awful time.
Oh, I bet you did. Yeah, they couldn't read English, and they, well, barely anyway, and they probably didn't have much respect for the laws.
But anyway, it was the one. I quit, and I sold my building, and he made the Southeast Asian funeral home out of it. And the University of Minnesota had a satellite clinic on East Side St. Paul. They asked me to be chief. Chief Discipline of Snow, I called it. that's what the Sheehan called Oxford. Chief Discipline of Snow. But anyway,
that's where you got that.
They hired me to be there to monitor 11 residents in their freshly hatched out residence. I worked there for 2 years, and I really got along well with the residents. And they really thought that more teachers should have my background in the, when they're teaching them the practical factors they knew nothing about.
Mm.
They figured it's all by looking up in the book. And my biggest problem with these young, freshly hatched out doctors would be a patient would come in, grandma would come in 80 years of age, and they would order $1,500 worth of tests. And when the tests came back, then they'd go see her. No, you go in there and you talk to her and hold her hand, get acquainted with her, find out what's the matter. No, I'll find out when the tests come back. That's not the way you practice medicine.
Yep.
You find out what's wrong. Oh, I had quite a time with you. But they all succumbed to my pressure. They felt, before I finished my 2 year stint, they all thought that I was on the right track. Learn about the patient first before you order all kinds of stuff.
Treat the patient like a human being instead
exactly
of a machine.
Exactly right. This is what I told
them. Yeah.
And after 2 years, I decided to. Why did I really quit? They wanted me to head up the whole thing. The university did. Who was they? They called me and they wanted to know if they had 4 or 5 satellite clinics. Would you mind heading this all up? I said, I can't for you. I was already 10. How old am I now? I'm going to be 90. And I was about 80 years old then. Well, that's too late to be. And yet I was...
A whole new project, yeah.
Yeah, so I didn't take much.
Now, when were you born exactly?
1914.
Okay, and what? Which date?
We were born in my... I was born right on a farm. 80-acre farm. 7.5 miles southeast of Holdingford, Minnesota.
And where is Holdingford exactly?
Holdingford is about 30 miles 30 miles northwest of St. Cloud.
Oh, okay.
Littleburg. Yeah. 500 population. That's where I worked for those farmers. Our 80-acre farm was right there. St. Wendell was our parish, Irish parish. And St. Wendell was out of St. Cloud, about 18 miles. And our 80 acres was 3 miles north of St. Wendell. And then there were 13 kids in my family, 9 boys and 4 girls.
Whoa!
On the 80-acre farm, and we had no indoor plumbing, no running water. We grew our own vegetables and our own hogs and the like. But my first job. I was 15 years of age when I first left home to work for. I worked for a farmer near Avon first.
I remember seeing that.
I worked for a farmer, a German farmer near Avon. And Avon, Schmitz were the big family in Avon. They ran a ball club and they wanted me to be on the ball team. Yes, I was on the ball team, but I was 15 years of age and they had the Obermillers and the Hirons and the... anyway, I didn't make the team. I didn't care. But I was glad I was on the team. And I worked for that farmer, and then 2 years later, I worked for the farmer in Golden Park.
Otto Stein. Now, what's your birthday?
February 24th, 1914.
Oh, February 24th.
Yeah,
that's 2 days away from my wife's birthday.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Where were you born?
I was born October 21st, 1957.
Where?
In Madison, Wisconsin.
Madison, Wisconsin.
Yeah, yeah.
I had a tough time with Madison. They had a good ball club.
Yeah, in the 3-I League.
In the 3-I League, when I was with Moline, I pitched against Madison a couple of times.
Did you ever pitch in Madison?
Oh, yeah.
Did you pitch at Bree Stevens Field?
I'm sure I
That's
did.
What it was, Bree Stevens Field.
I'm sure I did, but I...
Stone walls.
They were a tough ball club. Moline was a patsy, though.
Well, I guess you explained the reason why. Maybe you would have been better if that catcher hadn't been giving away your pitches.
But I'll tell you one thing. We were playing in, I was with the Millers at that time. So I don't know how that fits in. I was a rookie on the Miller team. They called me. They recalled me when I was pitching for Crookston. And I got the telegram in Eau Claire when we were playing Eau Claire. Report. You're going to pitch tomorrow's game against the St. Paul Saints. God, I was happy. Not them.
Oh.
I pitched a game against the Saints. And in the eighth
and
inning...
That was either in Minneapolis? Or at St. Paul?
St. Paul.
That was at St. Paul, Lexington Park.
Wait a minute. I think, yes, it was in Lexington Park. Okay. Because they played two games that day. One in the forenoon was in... Nicollet Park in Minneapolis, and the afternoon game was
Lexington
Park.
Yeah.
That was the afternoon game.
Yeah.
And Tom Sheehan, I reported to Tom Sheehan. Well, Lexi, you'll pitch tomorrow against the Down the River Bastards. He said, "See, Paul the Down the River Bastards." He said,
Oh, that's funny. Now, had you started a game yet at this point in time?
That was
your first one.
First game. And Tom Sheehan told me, Lefty, don't let him know you got good control. Throw the first one behind his head. He said, don't let him know you got... And I went 8 innings, and we were ahead when they took me out. But Tom Sheehan said, Lefty, make him hit that strong ball, and keep your fastball 6 inches on either side of the plate. And if they go for it, they won't drive it anywhere else. He was a good coach, and yeah. I don't know why they took me out. We were ahead 3-2 when they took me out, and Tom Sherr, I think, finished the game, and Morton hit a home run off him and one on the ninth inning we lost.
Oh, you had a complete game going.
I had a complete game going, but they took me out.
Huh.
And Morton hit a home run. I'm sure it was off of Walter Tausch. I'm pretty sure they put it, whoever it was. I was sick when he took me out because I was getting them out.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
Well, I don't know. I was getting them out.
Well, I remember looking you up in here, and I wasn't sure how many innings you were given credit for, so I wanted to double check that. But you had at least eight, but you had two decisions. Weren't you 0-2?
I won one game against Milwaukee once.
Okay, let's see what this says here now.
I finished the game against Milwaukee. I don't know what I got wiped out.
Anyway, you might not have got the win for that one.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. Minneapolis, Ernie Sawada, 0-2 is what they've got you down for. I'm going to make a little booklet of your record at home. I'm going to send it to you.
Yeah, I guess maybe that's right. I started another game.
And they've got you down for two games and then six innings pitched. That's what they got you down for, six innings pitched.
I pitched more than that, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
I know they took me out in the eighth inning, and then the other time was, I don't know who we were playing. I think it was Milwaukee. And,
would this have been in Milwaukee, or?
In Milwaukee, yeah.
Okay.
And the other thing that happened, when I was with the Millers as the rookie, we were playing Toledo once. Toledo. What happened? And the rookies, or anybody who wasn't playing, had to shag fly balls in batting practice. And so I was shagging fly balls in batting practice out in the outfield, and the background music started playing Wishing Will Make It So.
That's right.
Just keep on wishing and cares will go. Well, I reversed that. I all of a sudden thought, wishing is not enough. I'm going to quit baseball. I'm knocking my head out. I don't have it. I don't have enough to make a living playing professional baseball. I'm in the wrong racket. And I listened to the background music. And the background music, I said, wishing does not make it so. My will tells me I've got to do something else. And that's when I decided to go to med school full time. And that's when the World War II broke out. And that's when I was chief engineering officer on the destroyer for 4 years. And I put the USS Hanson Commission as chief engineering officer, and this is being a little bit divergent, but I have to tell you about this. We were for our shakedown cruise. We went down to Cuba, Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and we had a 6-week shakedown cruise. The atomic bomb hadn't been dropped yet, and our destroyer was being primed. For the mainland attack on Japan. That was supposed to have been our next assignment. And we had a boarding party of about 6 or 8 officers whose only job was to be aboard ship, and they put you through all the phases. Engineering division and the CNR division and the gunnery division and the 8 different divisions. And we were put through our paces. This was the USS Hanson, the brand new destroyer. And then they were all in the wardroom. So help me God if I'm lying to you now. We were sitting in the wardroom, and this the evaluation board, first the gunnery division, is not ready yet for active duty. This CNR division, not ready yet. I was just holding my breath. But we got down to the engineering division. Of the 256 ships that we have inspected since the beginning of the war, 4 years ago, this engineering division has run the best of any division, any ship that we have ever inspected. We give the chief engineering officer an A+ for all that he has done. The crew respects him. He respects the crew. He knows how to delegate responsibility, and the captain. So that was his mouth open.
Was that Parham?
Parham.
Uh-huh.
Next day, or 2 days later, I was assigned to Commander Destroyers Atlantic Fleet Staff.
At the what?
Commander Destroyers Atlantic Fleet Staff.
The Atlantic Fleet Staff.
Yeah, and all I had to do then, if a destroyer in the Mediterranean or in the Atlantic had engineering problems, they'd fly me out,
uh-huh.
And I wouldn't have to fix it, but I had to be able to tell them what's wrong.
Uh-huh.
But I was amazed at that.
Oh, man.
What did that
feathering mean? Your cap right there.
God, that made my ego.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm not all that bad. I must have been pretty good.
Probably made you feel like you could do about anything.
I really felt good. And I asked the head of the man, the head of the division, who did the evaluation. He says, you know how to delegate responsibility. Your chiefs respect you. Your first class respect you. You know how to pass on the responsibilities. You don't try to do it all yourself. But when you've got 95 men in a division, you can't do it all yourself. But you got to trust your men.
Mm.
And one time, and off of the, this was when I was on Georgia, off the Omaha Beach, we absorbed a derangement enough of mist that the framework of the ship was buckled a little bit, and the main generator, our main turbo generator, was attached to the framework of the ship in such a way that there was a misalignment of the bearings, and the bearings were running hot. So I called the bridge and I said, Captain, we'll have to secure number one generator. The bearings are running hot and there is a misalignment.
But and now what caused that?
That was a near miss. We have
from a submarine, or
it was one of those stinking little son of a bitch in torpedo boats.
Oh!
They came out of the sunset because we couldn't see them. Yeah, and but they didn't incapacitate us totally. But we were a little bit handicapped. And so I told Chief Maupin and Chief Ewan, my two first, my chief machinists. I had four of them. And they told me it can't be fixed. We have to go to the Navy Yard. You son of a bitch, you don't get out of the line of fire here.
Yeah.
So I put the two chiefs on first class watch. And I took Martin and Donnelly, two first class off of watch, first class machinists. I took them off a watch. I put the two chiefs to stand their watches. And Donnelly and Martin and I worked on those generators about 18 hours, and we had them buried like kittens.
Wow, how'd you do that?
Well, you see, there you've got this turbo generator has a big shaft, you know, thing. But I knew that there were shims. You take a few out of here and put them on this side, and you can realign the misalignment by juggling shims. But it's a big job. The bearings are so big that you had to lift them off with a block of hands.
Oh, I believe that.
But by then, we had those generators purring like a kitten. Listen to this. I called the bridge. Captain, we're ready for anything. He said, Lefty, good going. Tell the chiefs to pack their bags. Both of the chiefs who refused to do it were on the next mail boat back to England. Damn right. Captain said, we don't have people like that aboard ship.
They got shipped out.
They got shipped out, yeah.
Oh, man.
Well, yeah, they did. And the generator worked fine. And you know what? The best part of it was, I rated the Martin and Donnelly chief. Two first class. I made them chief. I made two second class first class. I made two third class second class. Everybody was happy. All we missed was two recalcitrant chiefs.
And whatever happened to them?
You know what? I asked the captain, what happens to these people? Oh, they'll be given an assignment on some remote tugboat. They'll be swinging around on some buoy, some ocean-going tugboat that goes up to pick up survivors or cargo when a ship gets sunk and the like. That's where they belong.
Yeah, not as much action.
No, but he said, captain said, they'll be fighting the seagull. Wipe the seagull shit off the tugboat deck.
Oh my gosh. Here, I gotta read you a few of these names. I'm gonna steer you back to baseball here a little bit. I'm looking at the 1940 Millers team.
Yeah.
Okay? And I'm just gonna look at the pitchers at first. Did you know Harry Kelly at all?
I sure did. He was a very nice fellow. He was, I don't know what he threw. But he was getting the men out. Kelly was a good pitcher.
Yeah.
And he was a quiet man. Yeah, he'd give me good advice, but he won his ball games. He And he was a man who was even tempered. He never showed sign of agitation. No way. He could pitch a two-hitter, and it'd be no different than if he had gotten knocked out of the box in the third inning. He was even tempered.
Wow. That's amazing. Well, he has the best record on the team at 16-9 that year.
Yeah, that's a beyond.
And he had a very good strikeout-to-walk ratio. He had 90 strikeouts and only 69 walks.
Yeah, he was good.
So, and he did give up the most hits of anyone in the association. He gave up 295 hits. So, but he had 12 complete games, and he was in 42 games, and he had 2 shutouts, but he also had 249 innings pitched. So there's the reason why he gave up so many hits. He played a lot.
Is Butland in there?
What's his name?
Bill Butland? Herb Hash?
Yeah, I'll go down. I don't see Butland right away here. Let's see. It goes like this. Weintraub, Treat.
First base. Weintraub was the
yep.
Jewish first baseman.
Oh, he was Jewish?
Yeah, he was a good fellow.
Treachop.
Treachop was a shortstop. I'll tell you a story about him. We were playing Toledo, and we were practicing. Getting ready for the game, and Treachok was standing, his mouth was open all the time. She didn't yell that. Treachok, for God's sake, move around. I don't mind if you just stand there and do nothing, but when the flies are going in and out of your mouth, let's go poof off.
Oh my gosh. That's pretty funny, because you know what that reminds me of? I used to play the piano, and I'd practice at home. I'd be practicing the piano. I'd be looking at the notes. My dad would come in. He'd say, "You catching any flies?" My dad was in the military. He was in the Philippines, in Australia, New Guinea. Anyway, okay. How about Geary? Eugene Geary.
Shortstop.
And what did you call him?
Shortstop. G-E-A-R-Y. Hunk Geary. He was a shortstop, and he was a good one.
You called him Huck?
Huck was his nickname. H-U-C-K. I liked him. He was a gentleman.
Oh, okay. Well, good. That's good to have Huck down there. Good. I didn't know his nickname. How about, Fawcett? That's Buck Fawcett, isn't
Buck
it?
Buck Fawcett. He was a third baseman. Buck Fawcett was good. He would tell me how to pitch to the different hitters. Yeah. Buck was okay. I liked him. And Pofahl was shortstop. I don't know if you got him down there.
Now, what's his name?
P-O-F-A-H-L. Pofahl. He was a Faribault boy, and he was with the Millers for several years. He went to Washington.
Let me put his name down here, because I don't see it. And that's one of the things. This book has most of the principal players, but it doesn't have some of the secondary players.
Pofahl was the shortstop, and he was from Faribault, and he played with Rochester when I was pitching for Faribault after the war.
I'm going to look his name up in the back here real quick to see if maybe they have him. They might have him on a different team, too. But he was from Faribault. P-O-F-A-H-L?
Pofahl, yeah.
Okay, let's see. They have him 247.
Would you want a cup of coffee?
Oh, no, that's okay. But go ahead and help yourself.
Well, no, I can get right.
If you're all right, I mean, because you know, I'll be honest with you. When this side of the tape runs out, I think I'm going to go. But you know what? I might want to come back.
Yeah,
would that be okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, because I didn't want to take up your whole afternoon, and I've got chores to do at home as well. Let's see. They've got either. Let's see. Pofahl.
He was sent. He was sold to the Minneapolis Senators. From the Washington Senators.
Okay, from Minneapolis?
Yeah.
Yeah, he ought to be coming up here. Here we go. Shortstop and second baseman for Indianapolis in 38. And then they've got him, if we can find him again here. Pofahl. Jim. 52 and 85. 52. Yep, Minneapolis. Yep, there he is. 1939. He was the full-time shortstop.
Full-time shortstop.
And yep.
He's the Washington Senators bought his contract.
Okay. And then, let's see, 285. He's back with the Millers again in 43.
Yeah.
And Frankie Daneker is on that team playing first base, and he did some outfield. Then Popal and Trechak. And that's getting beyond us. So we're going to go back to 40 here. Go back to 40.
Buck Fawcett, you mentioned that.
Buck Fawcett.
Yeah, and Otto Denny was the catcher. He was a good one. Otto Denny was okay.
As I recall, Denning was born in Wisconsin.
I think he was, yes.
I'm not 100% sure, but I remember.
And
then we've got Ab Wright.
Abby Wright played the left field, and he was a big man, and he could hit that ball a ton. Abby Wright was, he was a nice one. I liked him, but I was glad I didn't have to pitch against him.
I'll bet, huh?
He was a big man, and one time I will never forget, he asked Tom Sheehan, Abby was about 220 pounds, and he says, Tom, the catcher blocked my way when I was coming home, and he wouldn't let me get into the home plate. Is it right, if it happens again, is it right if I really let him have it? And she said, and I'll be right there to cut myself off a piece of tenderloin.
A piece of tenderloin, wow, that's great. Okay, so Wright was a big guy. I'm just going to mark it down.
He was a big man, yeah. He could hit the ball.
Well, yeah, they got him leading the association in hits.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, not in hits. He had a lot of hits. He had most on the team. He had 213 hits in 1940. But he had 159 RBI.
Yeah.
And that was most in the association. And 39 home runs that year. Well, this was his major year, 1940. And 39 home runs, so that was the league lead, and 369 average. Boy, that's a hell of an average, 369, 1940.
And then Jimmy Wasdell was a little bit, he was Jimmy Wasdell and Walker. Those two were outfielders for the Millers.
Okay.
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, but those are important because I don't have those in the book.
Wasdell was a good ball player, and I walked, and they were gentlemen. They were okay. You know, Chief Hogsett was tremendous. He was forever worried that I didn't have enough money. We'd be on the road, and he said, "Listen, do you need anything? Are you sure you have enough money?" He'd be forever giving me a $20 bill or a $10 bill, yeah?
Man, I'll tell you what, they used him too because he won 16 and lost 11 that year.
Yeah.
And he had the very good percentage of 593 in 41 games.
Is that Hogsett?
Hogsett.
And he was with Clara City when I was pitching for Rumor.
Oh my gosh. Well, this guy got around, didn't he?
Well, he was on the way down then.
Okay. Now, he had one shutout. He had 210 innings pitched. That's earning your paycheck.
Yeah, but you know, Tom Sheehan, the manager, when he put Hogsett on the mound, he forgot about it. The other pitchers he'd watch. Like the one time when Hawks said bases got full and we were 5-3 or something like that ahead. Tom pulled it out of the dugout. "Chief, what the hell do you think you're doing out there? Chasing a moose up the big woods?"
And where was he from? Northern Minnesota or?
Yeah.
I wonder where he was from.
What a gentleman.
Oh,
what a gentleman, I'll tell you.
Well, look, he wasn't a gentleman to the batters. He had 104 strikeouts.
He told me when he was with Clara City, "Well, Lefty," he said, "we are on different teams now. You do your best, and I have to do my best, too."
Yeah, he was one of the best pitchers on the Millers. Then the next pitcher after Hawks said, we've got Tauscher.
Walter Tauscher was from Rhinelander, Wisconsin. And Walter and Tauscher and I, we didn't have any trouble, but I couldn't quite identify with him. I don't know why. The other pitchers treated me like a son or something. But Walter was a little different. I couldn't identify with him. But with Otto Denny and Hub Walker and Wasdell and Huck Jury and the third baseman you mentioned, they were tremendous. What Fawcett? Popal was a little bit aristocratic. He was a little bit uppity, and he played for Rochester when I pitched for Fairbanks.
Okay.
Hofall played shortstop for Rochester. Rick Gleason played for Rochester. Louis Cardinal played for Rochester.
And who was that last one?
Rick Gleason. I don't know if he made the big leagues or not.
Because this book is strictly American Association. Oh. They have Gleason in here. I've got a William Gleason and a Dennis Gleason and a Jay Gleason. Would it be Dennis?
One of those. I think maybe
49.
Jay, he was a redhead. And he was farmed out. The first time I met him was out pitching for.
Well, they've got him with Columbus in 38 as a teammate of Dick Siebert.
That was the reason, yeah.
Dick Siebert. I'll put brown red by his name now. I'm not sure if that's it, but I'll just put it brown red. Because maybe that's one of the reasons why Siebert ended up coming to Minnesota, because Siebert was a Massachusetts-born boy.
I'll tell you about Dick Siebert, and then I'll shut up. After the war. After the war, when Faribault offered me a contract, and I had offers from different teams to Kelly wanted me to sign up with the Millers again. No, I'm finished. I know I don't have it. But I went to see Dick Siebert. I said, I just signed the contract with Faribault. Could I get to shape? Lefty, come on down there with me. He went down to the rock room and he told the property room manager, give this man a locker and give him a suit and don't give him any static. He said, Lefty, you work out with us whenever you want. And I got into the shape. I get out of the day practice, you know, for 2-3 hours in the afternoon. But I was in med school then, after the war. But Dick Siebert gave me a wide open welcome. Mm. Yeah, he really did.
Man,
introduced me to the baseball team, Minnesota baseball team. And don't give Lefty any static. He's like one of us now.
instant approval.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
He said, Lefty is one of us now. I got into shape with the Gophers. I work out with them from 2 every afternoon, and I sneak out of the lab. I told the doctor, whoever was, Boyden was the lab man, and I said, I have to get into shape for baseball too. That's okay. He said, that's okay. You know, these profs at the U loved it. Every time, the rest of the students would be mad at me. Monday morning would come along and they'd say, Lefty, how did you make out yesterday? The profs were on my side. You know, they loved it. They thought it was good. Dr. Boyden told me, Lefty, the best thing that could possibly happen is if 3/4 of these kids would do what you did. Knocked around. If they would have worn more hats in their lives, they'd be better doctors. Here they're kids, they don't know how to blow their nose, and they're going to be turned loose upon the public and unsuspect. Oh, the prof. The prof told me, you'll be the doctor. Doctor, who was it? One of the doctors told me, Lefty, don't even worry about a building. Get yourself a wide umbrella, big umbrella. Set it up on any street corner in St. Paul, and you'll be busier than hell before you know it.
A big umbrella. That'd be kind of an interesting thought. Come on in, you can have your blood pressure checked.
But anyway, they were on my side.
Wow.
And they told me, you wore many hats in your lifetime. You understand human nature.
Yep.
God, yeah.
And the only way you're doing that is by being out there.
By being out there, yeah.
Yep.
One time we were playing Benson, and I hate to say this, we're playing Benson, and Cracker McCarthy was the hitter, and the bases were, I don't know what. Anyway, it was a tight ball game. And I, eighth inning, and it was 1-1 or something like that. And I told the umpire, Cracker McCarthy's head is over the plate. And I said, how can I pitch to him? His head is over the plate. The umpire says, you pitch him and I'll call him. I thought for sure I killed him. And the umpire called him out. His head was in the strike zone, and I hit him on the head, and he was in the hospital for about a week.
No batting helmets then either.
No batting helmets. But his head was over the plate. Who am I? I pitched to the umpire. You pitch him and I'll call him. I clocked him. And, but his head was over the plate. Mm-hmm. I needed to do it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I can imagine. You didn't have much choice.
I didn't have it. Anyway, Lefty Ranweiler was with Bird Island at that time, and then he was Cookston, I mean, Wilbur signed him up for the next year. And Lefty Ranweiler died an early death, and I went to his funeral in Wilbur. This was not first, I was in practice already.
Now, was this the one that had his head hit?
No, there's another one.
Okay.
The fellow I talked to, he was at the funeral. Lefty Ranweiler, I didn't know why he died. But Cracker McCarthy was there, and I felt guilty as well. Said, Lefty, don't feel guilty. You were the only pitcher who didn't like, who challenged me. I know my head was over the plate. This is the way I rattled the pitcher, but
yeah.
I couldn't rattle you.
Yeah.
And yeah, the pitcher was my territory. Yeah, he said, I don't blame you for hitting me.
Oh, man. Well, that's good, because he didn't have anybody to blame but himself. But that's where he was from, over in that area?
Yeah.
McCracken?
Cracker McCarthy.
McCarthy?
Cracker McCarthy.
Okay. Well, yeah. And he was on the receiving end of a Sawada fastball.
Yeah. And his head was over the plate, kadoom. I hit him right on the head. Only man I can think of that I hit. I may have hit other people, but I remember that one. And one of my teammates from St. John's University, Linus Evnett, was with Winnipeg in the Northern League.
Uppelman?
Ray Uppelman. And T-Catch got killed playing for Superior. T-K-A-C-H. Was at the game. But I was pitching that game. Who hit him? Somebody, a submarine ball pitcher hit him on the head and killed him. He died right at the plate.
Man. Whoa. But you probably had heard about the Carl Mays beating of Ray Chapman in 1920.
Yes, I read one. Okay.
Yeah, there's a book about that. I've read the book. And man, that is a fascinating story. I mean, it's a fascinating story, only because, you know, this was the big time.
Yeah.
You know, and Ray Chapman was such a rising star. And, you know, it's not to say that anybody else who gets, you know, even if you're a junior leaguer, you know, who gets hit by a pitch isn't, you know, a star too, because to me, that makes you an instant star. I mean, in a way, you know, if you think about it. But
you know, one of the things that strikes me when I think about it now, Bill Barnacle and Daneker and there were others. I asked them, because they were with Winnipeg when I was pitching for Cookston and Duluth, and they all told me the same thing. Lefty, you had good enough control, but yes, you could keep the ball outside and inside. They all told me the same thing. But we knew that your ace pitch was that changeup. And you wouldn't get by in the big leagues with just a changeup. You were not quite quick enough, he said. Lefty, you just didn't have enough.
Not enough stuff.
Bill Barnacle told me that. Daneker told me that. Daneker became, when he was with the Minneapolis Millers, he came to me, I took care of him, delivered his kids, and took care of him. Came to me and he wasn't feeling good. He said his shoulders bothered him a little. He had a funny something not right, and I couldn't put my finger on it. But I knew, my better judgment told me that Frankie, even though he was in his early 40s then, had a severe illness here. And I sent him to Dr. Zahn Miller, the best neuropsychiatrist and the neurologist, the best one that I knew. And Dr. Zahn Miller asked me, well, Lefty, why are you sending him to me? I really don't find too much wrong. The muscles in his shoulders and in his neck, there's something not right there. And
that you were just sensing this,
more or less.
And you were using information from Daneker himself to determine that.
Exactly right. His manager died at an early age, about a year later. And Zandler asked me, Lefty, how did you know? I said, I don't know how I knew. But I knew that Frankie was afflicted with a severe illness, like amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or something like that. Something similar to fatal nerve disease, you know? And so he died, and I took care of him until he died. And
I just want to write down what year he died, because I'm not going to find that information. I mean, I wasn't sure if Daneker ever made the bigs.
He stayed with Minneapolis 7 years, and he never went to the big leagues.
Yeah, so he died in approximately what year?
God, it must have been about 60, early 60s, I would think. And he didn't go to big leagues. How do I know that? Because he, when he quit playing baseball, he drove an oil truck and he delivered oils to different homes.
Fuel oil, isn't it?
Yeah. And I asked John Miller, the neurosurgeon that I sent him to, and he was a very sharp man. He said, Ernie, I wish I could tell you what was the real problem with Frankie Daneker, but how did you know that this was a serious illness? I said, I don't know, but I knew that he's going to have a problem. And Miller told me, Dr. John Miller said, I really can't tell you why he died. But he had a wasting disease. He got to the point where he couldn't move his neck. His arms wouldn't move. Then he lost control of his bowel and his bladder, and his whole nervous system just went to pot. And I don't know why.
You know what that reminds me of? Is I don't know if it's anything to do with it, but Bob Allison. And the disease Bob Allison had, which I don't remember what it's called, but wasn't that a type of a wasting disease?
It's the same thing. Bob Allison, his mind went too.
And Daneker was still sharp?
He was very sharp until Thursday, the last couple of months. But the first motor changes were the first ones that were significant. And John Moore thought, I did a good job of picking that up the way I did. But you go on and I had the advantage of before I went to med school, I lived with my grandmother the last 2 years in high school. The first year I worked on a farm for my boarding home, and I had to haul a 6-year-old daughter to kindergarten on my bicycle, 2.5 miles, morning and night, you know. But the farmer that I worked for, they were good people. They really, I enjoyed it.
Now, was that Stein or not?
No, that was Nick George. Therefore,
was that after Stein's?
I quit Stein's, and I then I was at Nyworth for 3 months. And Nyworth got me a job where I could work for my boarding home for this farmer, the Nick George farm, and then he got me into high school.
You really got a lot of work in that amount of time.
My job was to haul the little Marianne George on the framework. I put a raptor collar on the handlebar so she wouldn't be 2.5 miles every morning and every night. I hauled it to school with my bicycle.
And those roads weren't exactly smooth then.
Gravel roads. But it wasn't too bad.
Oh my gosh, no wonder you made it to almost 90 years old.
But they were good things. Oh, Nick George was a good man. He hugged me quite a lot. He was forever losing his pipe. Do you understand German?
A little.
I didn't understand, but I learned it because they were German fans. He was forever losing his pipe. He hugged me pipe forlorn. He hugged me pipe forlorn. And I had to go find his pipe for him all that. He always left it around the sink in the little gas station that he had. He'd take his pipe out of the mouth, put it on, then he would catch the word. But they were good people. The Georges were good people. And the thing that helped me at Stein's more than anything was their windmill. You wouldn't believe this, but the stinking windmill. When Stein would tell me that I was too old for high school and too short for baseball and he was like peeing at the 40-mile-an-hour end, I used to listen to the windmill. The windmill would, Stein would tell me that I was inadequate for anything. The windmill would first tell me, you're inadequate. And then I'd listen some more, and the windmill would change. You're adequate. And a week later, I'd listen some more to the windmill and would say, quit. Subconscious to consciousness, I'll tell you. It made a Christian out of me. And the windmill convinced me that change inadequate to quit. And this is when I told science, I quit.
Man, that's interesting.
The windmill, from my subconscious to conscious.
Yeah.
So I'm in the process of finishing a book. And it's pretty much what you can see.
No kidding.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Well, we'll have to keep in touch.
Well, I'll tell you what.
And let me ask you, if you'd like to be on my mailing list
for this,
would you like to receive the newsletter?
That'd be great. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Let me do that. And I want to make a note of that. I have it in my book that's in the car.
I've got a bit of a surprise for you.
Oh, really?
Okay.
Sounds great. I love surprises. My dad's parents were all from Northern Poland.
Is that right?
That's right. And he died, my dad died 3 years ago, and they went to, I'm going to shut the tape machine off now here.